Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Slash Film Daily. Today is Monday, December 23rd, 2024. Today, we have a very special episode of the podcast. My name is Ben Pearson. I'm an editor at slashfilm.com. And listeners may remember that I teased the fact that I read a book recently that I would devote an entire episode to. And the time has come to finally talk about that. So some context here. In 2022, a company called Taschen released a limited edition book called Stanley Kubrick's The Shining. That was the result of a collaboration between filmmaker Lee Unkrich and the late Jonathan J.W. Rinzler, who died in 2021 after writing more than 20 books. Rinzler was the executive editor at Lucasfilm for 15 years and wrote an incredibly well-received making-of book about Star Wars. And his name is pretty legendary among film geeks for his ultra-detailed approach to uncovering secrets from beloved films. This special edition book about The Shining, which contained 6 volumes that included a facsimile of the script, some typewriter pages, and sketches from Saul Bass, who designed the movie's iconic poster, cost a staggering $2,500 and was limited to only 1,000 copies, and it's still sold out. But thankfully, as of this week, Taschen has now officially released a popular edition of the book that only costs $125. It doesn't have those things that I just mentioned, but it does have a 476-page scrapbook with behind-the-scenes photos from the production that almost no one has ever seen before, as well as another volume that's nearly 1,000 pages of writing containing everything you could possibly want to know about the making of the 1980 Kubrick classic. I thought I'd read detailed making-of books before, but I was mistaken, frankly. Stanley Kubrick's The Shining, which was edited by Unkrich and written by Rinzler, is hands down the most detailed accounting of a production that I've ever seen, and a genuinely remarkable piece of work that really takes you through the entire process of the movie, from Kubrick's earliest encounter with Stephen King's yet-to-be-published book and the handwritten notes that he jotted in the margins of its pages, all the way through to after the movie was released. It's the written equivalent of that Beatles documentary where you watch them in real time take the kernel of an idea and then eventually transform it into the version that we recognize. The insights provided here are just bonkers. Conversations that Kubrick had with his co-writer in the early days are all documented. Early versions of the script are presented. A famous alternate ending is explored in depth. And thanks to the mind-boggling amount of research done and information provided by the studio and Kubrick's archives, we're practically taken day by day through the entire pre-production, production, and post-production of this incredible movie. Along the way, there are interviews with seemingly every living person who worked on The Shining, some conducted in the late 70s and early 80s, around the time the movie was being made and came out, and others conducted within the past 10 years or so, mostly by Unkrich. As he explains in the intro of the book, he had gathered vast amounts of research, and Rinzler was the perfect person to actually organize all of that into a cohesive narrative. Lee Unkrich edited the original Toy Story and went on to co-direct Toy Story 2, Monsters, Inc., and Finding Nemo before serving as the primary director of Toy Story 3 and Coco. He worked on this book for 10 years, but his obsession with The Shining started much, much earlier, and we touch on that in this conversation we had a few weeks ago. I think it's important to note here that most people will not have read this book by the time this episode is coming out, so we framed the conversation in such a way that anyone who has seen The Shining can listen to it and hopefully enjoy it. We get into some really good stuff here, including a few quote-unquote mistakes that Kubrick made in the movie and whether they were intentional, how Shelley Duvall was treated on the set, which has been the subject of a lot of discussion over the past few years, and much, much more. So here is my conversation with Lee Unkrich. So congratulations on this book. I want to start at the end of your journey. So by providing such a detailed breakdown of The Shining's production and pulling the curtain back about exactly how it came together, did it feel like the publication of this book was a cathartic act that freed you from your obsession, or does this movie still have a hold on you?
I think both. I think that I think my obsession will never leave me, because I just know it's inevitable that someone's going to come out of the woodwork with some information or a photo or something that I haven't seen, and I'll spend the rest of my life regretting wasn't in the book. And I'll be thrilled to see that when that day comes. So my obsession is still there in that regard. But yes, it also does feel cathartic to finally have it out in the world. You know, when we published the collector's edition 18 months ago, it felt like it was kind of over, but it never really felt satisfying because I knew that there were only 1,000 people in the world that could see the book, and I knew a lot more than that were really interested in the film and wanting to read the book. So when this comes out later this month, I think finally I'll be able to feel like the project is done,
Yeah.
and I think that will feel cathartic, certainly.
I just finished reading it literally this morning, and it is incredible, man. You guys did such a great
Thanks.
job with it. So,
Thanks.
okay, so I want to go back to the beginning now, and you saw the movie when you were around 12 years old,
Yeah, I
and
was 12.
it eventually inspired you to want to be a director. And I love that the memory that you shared in the book about reading your paperback of King's novel and realizing that one of the photos from that film was inside was from a scene that didn't make it into the actual movie, and that sent you on this quest to learn more about the making of it. That just feels like a real origin story moment.
Well, it was kind of the combination of that I realized that photo was not a scene in the movie. And I also, around the same time, had read about the fact that there had been this hospital epilogue on the movie that Kubrick had kind of cut out right after the limited release. So those two things kind of wormed their way into me and made me start obsessing over. It was mostly that I loved the movie so much and I wanted more. Like the idea that there was more that wasn't in the film became an obsession for me, and it was an obsession that I wasn't able to satisfy until 2011. So I spent so long trying to find, drafts of the screenplay or other photos, but like what was out on the internet was what was out on the internet, and there was nothing new coming along. While Stanley was alive, certainly that was never going to happen because he held such a tight grip over everything. And then once he died and eventually his family opened up his archives, then a little more kind of made its way out into the world. But I knew there had to be way more, which is why in 2011 I was finally able to visit the archive and go through all the stuff. And that's just a portion of all the stuff that I found that ultimately made it into the book. But I finally got a lot of questions answered and got to read those early drafts of the screenplay and all that.
Yeah, I mean, having that experience and then there just being such a lack of information out there at the time, has that inspired you as a filmmaker to sort of infuse your projects with as much behind the scenes stuff as possible to give people that thing that you didn't have as a kid if
I mean,
somebody is interested
we
in
always
learning
did
about it?
that from the first Toy Story. We were all, I mean, we were filmmakers, young filmmakers, but we were film fans as well. And so we were all watching Laserdiscs, back then, and watching the Criterion Laserdiscs and hearing the commentaries. And so from the moment Toy Story came out, we always loaded the DVDs and everything over the years with lots of information. I'm sure Stanley would not like all the things out in the world to be out in the world. I had very mixed feelings about publishing some images that he absolutely wouldn't have wanted to be seen. But I had to find a balance between respecting his wishes, but also feeling like I needed, like it was my responsibility to do a service to lovers of the film, lovers of Kubrick, future filmmakers. I mean, I'm of a mind that this stuff should be out in the world. I don't think anyone should ever try to like they can't because he burned everything, but that they should try to like restore a different version of the film. But I think it's okay to really understand how a great mind like Stanley's worked. And I think it's okay that he was vulnerable and didn't always have all the answers, and that's the kind of thing that comes to light by diving into the materials.
Yeah, absolutely. Is there a photo in particular that you're thinking of that you think he wouldn't necessarily approve of?
Well, I was thrilled when I discovered buried deep in the archives the still frames from the hospital epilogue. And they didn't even know they were in there. I found that they were in such a mislabeled place in the archive. And I just about lost it when I saw those and a lot of the other deleted images. Stanley just didn't, he didn't want it in the world. And I was actually a little, I was nervous about the Kubrick family seeing those images, even up to the, we had a release party at the Kubrick estate. And I knew that they were, some of them were looking at the book for the first time. And I was just, I was bracing myself for what? Wait, why are these in here? But no one ever said anything. And Jan approved the book. You know, he saw the galleys of the book before it was published, and he, I certainly didn't bring it to his attention,
Right.
but he leafed through the whole book, and so anyway, they're in there, and I'm really happy they're in there because they're really cool, and I love that I got to put images in the world that nobody's ever seen before.
Yeah, that's amazing. So you meet up with J.W. Rinzler and decide to collaborate on this book, with you handling a lot of the research and him handling the actual writing of the book. What did that collaboration actually look like in practice? Did you two build an outline together, or how did you weigh in on the actual writing of this thing?
Well, at the time that I started working with Jonathan, what happened was we had each, I think it's in the book, we had each reached out to the Kubrick estate around the same time with an interest in doing a book. And Jan didn't want to pick between the two of us, and he was kind of in a muddle about what to do. And so I said, well, why don't you tell me who the other person is and I'll reach out. Maybe we can work together. And so it turned out to be Jonathan Rinzler, and it turned out he lived in the Bay Area. So we got together, we had lunch at Pixar, and that was the beginning of it. I knew that I had a vast amount of research that I'd already done and had started doing interviews, but I didn't know how to write a book. And Jonathan knew how to write a book, and he'd written many, many books like this. And so it just seemed like a perfect partnership, and the Kubrick estate was happy to have us work together. So at the time, Taschen hadn't approved doing the book. So I ended up hiring Jonathan out of my own pocket to write the book. And basically, he has a method, a methodology that he applies to every making of book that he's done, which is he gets his hands on the daily production reports, which are a report to the studio of exactly what was shot every day on the set. And once we had that, that provided a framework for the telling of the story. And then everything, he dipped into all the research I'd done. He conducted a few interviews himself, but I was doing most of the interviews, and I would just that get them transcribed and sent to him. And he just over time built out a first draft, which we reviewed, and we ended up shortening it by about a third. Like it was about a third more material. It's already a long book, but and I'm grateful to Taschen that they let us publish such a text-heavy book, which is not something they do. Yeah, it was just a wealth of material, and it was like it was a joy working with him. You know, unfortunately, he passed away before the book came out, which was a huge tragedy. I think this was the thing he was the most proud of that he ever wrote. Like he was just like really honored that he got to write about a Kubrick film.
Yeah, that's so great.
So I had to take it across the finish line without him, unfortunately. But so I ended up writing all the captions for the book, most of them, and worked with the designers in Paris at MM to figure out, you know, how the book was going to feel. And they th thankfully gave me a, you know, they designed the concept of the book and did all the layouts, but they deferred to me in terms of which photos to use. So I got to edit both the scrapbook and everything in the manual and figure out exactly what I wanted and which pages I wanted it on. So that was a lot of fun. I'd never done
Yeah,
anything.
that's so cool. So yeah, it's one thing to read about the stuff that happens in this book. Like, there's this moment where the helicopter is not allowed to touch down on the ground in
Yeah.
Glacier National Park while the second unit was filming that opening helicopter shot. And it's one thing to read about that, but then you actually have photos where you see a person like literally jumping up to the helicopter to like, pass them something or whatever they're doing. And it's just amazing the
That
level of
stuff
detail.
exists.
Yeah,
Yeah.
exactly. Like that just kind of blew my mind seeing that stuff.
Well,
So
and that
how
was,
do
you know, like I said, there was a lot of stuff in the archive that was awesome, but the one thing they didn't have a lot of were photos. They had a lot of photos from certain set pieces in the film, like the big gold ballroom scene. They shot a lot of photos and some other bits here and there, but it wasn't exhaustive coverage. He didn't have a dedicated photographer on set. So that was my one worry early on, is whether we would have enough great photos to be worthy of doing a Taschen book. And that's where, you know, the 8 to 10 years I spent tracking people down was worth it, because I just found treasure troves along the way. And one of them was Greg McGillivray, who was the second unit director. He had all these slides of not only that shooting the title sequence, but he also went and visited the set, and Stanley let him take a bunch of pictures there. So he had a whole bunch of great images. He allowed me to see things that I never would have seen otherwise, like Jack and Danny and Wendy in the car, filming the VW drive up. That's the kind of rear projection stuff. I had never seen any images of that until found his photos, and then later Danny's father, Jim Lloyd, Jim and Ann, his parents, gave me access to like 450 color negatives and some black and white that they had taken on the set that had just been in a trunk in their basement for 40 years.
Man, for somebody
So once I
who's,
started finding these and others, I was like, okay, we have a Tashin book here.
yeah, I mean, I just can't imagine. Like, for somebody who's been on a treasure hunt for that long, there's so many amazing treasures that you found over the
You
course
can't
of
even
time.
imagine me, like I would sit like with the negatives, I would do like a low res scan of the strip. Yeah, that's what I would do. And I would just wait. The clock would spin, and then I would see, and I'd zoom in and be looking at these images for the first time, and I was just dying. Like you can't even imagine. And I hope people have the feeling leafing through the book that I had getting to see those images for the first time.
Yeah, it's so great.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I want to ask about the interview process that you did. And do you think your association with Pixar helped you get in the door with anyone in terms of doing interviews with the
Oh,
folks?
sure. I mean, it's what got me in with Yan in the first place. I wasn't just some Yahoo saying I want to do a Shining book. Like he respected the films I'd made, and so yeah, it definitely opened doors. And then once I started reaching out to people and tracking them down, you better believe I leaned into like I mean, I had my standard opening, explaining what my pedigree was, what I'd done, and that I was doing this in conjunction with Warner Brothers and the Kubrick estate, like doing everything I could to get people to even talk to me because, Stanley drilled such secrecy into everybody that even decades later, there were people that were kind of hesitant to talk to me. Even when I found Danny Lloyd, I finally tracked him down, and it was before he was doing any public appearances or anything. And I had to get him connected with Yan before he would even talk to me because he wanted to know for sure it was okay. Because here, I mean, it's like decades later, and he's still like, I don't want to make the Kubricks unhappy.
Yeah, I'm just trying to think about what you said to these people when you're talking. You couldn't have just been like, tell me everything you remember about working on The Shining. But like, how did you guide people toward these amazing recollections that they had from this thing that they did decades before?
A lot of times people would just start rambling and tell me everything they remembered. And I would let them go. But I also had a list of kind of standard questions to ask. Some of those were fed to me by Jonathan, just from his years of experience. He asked me to always ask them about when they saw the movie for the first time and what they thought of it. And that ended up becoming kind of the meat of one of the chapters toward the end of the book, which was nice. So yeah, I mean, it really was about, I really just tried to mine everybody for as much as they would give me. And there were some people that it was clear they had their set stories that they had told at dinner parties over the years. And when I tried to dig deeper, I'd get, oh, I don't know, that was a long time ago. But then there were other people that unexpectedly had like photographic memories, like interestingly, Joan Honor Smith, the woman who airbrushed Jack into the photo at the end, Stanley wanted her to do the work at the studio. So she was brought to the studio every day and she stood around a lot waiting to show her work to Stanley. And so she would be on the set and hanging out with Shelley. I remember when I was going to do that interview, I told my wife, I don't think this one's going to be very long. I'll be on with her maybe half an hour. And it was like 2.5 hours later, I'm still on with her because she just was going on and on and on and had so many interests. It was like completely lucid, as if it had just happened yesterday. And that was true with Greg McGillivray too, the guy who directed the second unit. He just had those two the most had a really photographic memory. Otherwise, it was kind of like the people who were young back then, like Vivian Kubrick and Zach Weinstein, who was a PA on the set. They had the best memories because they were young when all that was happening. And it was the older people that either it was just so long ago or they were getting up there in years and just didn't remember a lot. But I did the best I could. I even talked to the families of people who had passed away to see if they had memories of that time. And I tried to leave no stone unturned. That was like a real joy of doing this book, was tracking everybody down and getting to talk to them.
Yeah, it really feels like truly definitive. It's clear that Kubrick was legendarily meticulous in the making of this movie, but how do you explain the Charles Grady, Delbert Grady thing? Like, when it comes to genius filmmakers, where do we draw the line between everything was done for a reason and people are human and sometimes make mistakes?
Well, I can talk about that because I think there's both going on in the movie. I think there's stuff that Stanley very deliberately put in because he thought it would be cool, or he was trying to evoke a feeling of uncanniness in the audience. That was a big one that I know he had conversations with Diane Johnson about, the screenwriter. But the Charles Delbert thing, here's the thing. I spent a decade of my life working on this book and getting answers to so many of my questions and finding out so many things that I didn't even think to ask about. But there are still a handful of things that I don't know. And no one can ever know because Stanley is not with us anymore. And even if he was, he wouldn't be giving interviews to talk about this stuff. So that Charles and Delbert Grady thing is one of them. Was it on purpose? I'd have to think it was. Why? I don't know. Like, because it's makes you feel a bit off that something's not right, you know. But then other things like Ullman talking about the girls as being like 8 and 10, two different ages when they're clearly visually twins. That I have an answer to, because that was one of the very first scenes they filmed, was that interview. And at the time they shot that, they hadn't yet cast Lisa and Louise. And they were looking for two girls to play sisters, not twins. They weren't looking for twins. And then Lisa and Louise showed up, and Leon Vitali, who was handling all that, remembered seeing Diane Arbus's photo of the twin girls that was so unsettling and weird, and he just thought, this is really cool, and I have to show them to Stanley. And he knew Stanley would love them, and he did. So why didn't they go back and rewrite that scene and reshoot it? Well, because he didn't want to, you know. I think he just chalked it up to Ullman doesn't really quite remember them or whatever, or he didn't think it mattered.
Yeah.
Stanley was making his movies at a time when people couldn't pore over them as meticulously as they can now and superimpose frames and digitally jump around and compare one background from one angle to another, like all that. Like, people just watch a movie. And so, yeah, he would have continuity errors. Sometimes they were probably mistakes in terms of what's in the background. I think a lot of times I was told Stanley didn't care about continuity. He just cared about the frame. And if there was a lamp in the background that he didn't like how it was feeling in the background, he would just tell people to take it out. I mean, in terms of the set dressing in that big Colorado lounge where Jack types, if you jump around through the movie as I have to the different times we're in there, all the furniture is in different places and different stuff on the tables and stuff disappears. And I never noticed for all the time I watched the movie, and it didn't matter. Like, why would I notice? But it is all over the place.
Yeah. Okay, so I only have a couple more questions for you. I don't want to take up too much more of your time, but what do you think were the biggest misconceptions about The Shining that your book was able to disprove?
Well, there's been a lot of talk in recent years that got really bad for a while about how Shelley was treated on the set. And Stanley has been really disparaged regarding the same. And from talking to people, and especially talking to Shelley, I just knew that this stuff wasn't true. I mean, there were grains of truth to some of it in terms of people losing tempers and stuff like that. But at the end of the day, there was only one person who I thought should ever speak to that topic, and that was Shelley. And anytime Shelley was asked about it by other journalists or by me, she always said the same thing, which is that Yes, it was a challenging movie to shoot, but she loved Stanley and she thought he got a great performance out of her. Like she never wavered from that. Even in the depths of her mental illness that she suffered later in life, she would do interviews occasionally and I would hear people like baiting her, trying to get her to say something bad. And she very innocently just stayed true to what all she ever said, which is that it was difficult, but she loved working with Stanley and she loved Stanley.
Yeah, I thought it was crucial that you actually have in your book interviews with her from that time, like before the movie even came out, where people were asking her about that. And she was acknowledging that he was using these tactics in order to get this performance out of her. Like she knew what he was doing and was fully aware of it at the time. You know, it's not like she was,
Yeah. I mean, there was stuff going on. Like Stanley asked some of his assistant directors to treat her, not treat her poorly, but like not be friendly, not be helpful, to just keep her in a state of being off center. So that like some of that's true, but it doesn't even come close to like being abusive in my mind,
Gotcha.
and not in Shelley's mind. I mean, she's not here to tell her stories anymore, but I'm glad I got to document them from her.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. So the last question I have, I know The Shining was a singular obsession for you for a long time, but is there any chance that you would think about putting together another book like this for a different movie? I just had such a great experience reading it and just being
Yeah,
absorbed
I
into the
think this
world.
is a one and done for me, especially with Jonathan gone. I don't have another movie that I mean, I have other movies that I really, really love, but not like I've never been obsessed with to the degree that I was with The Shining. I mean, The Shining just hit me at a very formative age and burrowed into me. And yeah, I don't think, yeah, people said, are you gonna do another Kubrick film? I'm like, no, I really don't want to. Like this for me was, I was gonna have this obsession whether I made the book or not. And I'm just glad that I like had a healthy outlet for it and that it wasn't just me in a basement, connecting photos with strings and slowly going insane. I got to put something out in the world that people seem to really enjoy and will be a good record of film history.
Definitely. Well, yeah, it's a spectacular piece of work. And congrats again. And thank you again for your time today. Really
Yeah,
appreciate it.
absolutely. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Cool. Thanks, Lee. All right. I hope you enjoyed that. Thanks again to Lee for being so generous with his time. And once again, Stanley Kubrick's The Shining is available from the folks at Taschen right now. You can find much more about The Shining at slashfilm.com. Slash Film Daily is typically published every weekday, bringing you the most exciting news from the world of movies and TV, as well as deeper dives into the great features you can find on the site. You can subscribe to the show on Apple, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and mailbag topics to us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. Make sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. Don't forget to take a minute to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That really helps us out a lot. Tell your friends about the show any way you can. We would really appreciate that. And I hope you all have a terrific Christmas. We've banked a bunch of list episodes that'll be coming out this week. I'm not sure what the schedule is going to be for next week yet. I suspect there will be several days off in there somewhere, but I'm guessing we'll be back on either Thursday, January 2nd, or Friday, January 3rd. So, thanks again for listening. Thank you for listening in all of 2024, and have an excellent and safe end of the year. Talk to you next time.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.